Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. He grew up in one room behind a South Carolina pool hall and ended up in the halls of Congress. Our guest today, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, likes to say his hardscrabble story is America's story. Graham was first elected to the U.S. House in 1994 in what was called the Republican Revolution. He went on to serve four terms there and is now in his third U.S. Senate term. Graham has made a name for himself over the years as a hawk on foreign policy, and as someone who can find middle ground with Democrats on issues like immigration and campaign finance. But now, as he runs for president, Graham's experience in Washington doesn't seem to be what Republican voters are seeking. Polls at this point, anyway, show the three D.C. outsider candidates, Trump, Carson, and Fiorina, way ahead of longtime politicians like Lindsey Graham. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Lindsey Graham, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Senator Graham, welcome. It's really nice to meet you.
Well, thank you. I keep thinking about the Saturday Night Live skit every time I sit here.
Now, why is that?
Well, you remember the public radio skit with Saturday Night Live?
I do remember that.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
All right. Well, we'll try to, it our own.
I'm trying to have my NPR voice.
You don't need to. As your mother said, just be yourself.
So that's good.
Just be yourself. And speaking of yourself, in this kind of anti-establishment, anti-Washington political climate that we're seeing in the GOP primary, how do you convince voters, Senator Graham, that your experience in Washington is an asset, not a liability?
Well, if it weren't for New Hampshire, it'd be very difficult to convince voters of anything because you'll never get to meet any. You know, this whole primary is about celebrity and insults and, you know, how people look. New Hampshire is a pathway forward for me. Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina are small enough states. I do weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, friendly divorces. I'm trying to meet as many people as I can and talk about why I think I'm most prepared to be commander-in-chief and why the next president needs to bring us together and solve problems like immigration and dealing with our national debt, and having some knowledge of how the system works is a good thing if you want to solve problems.
Sounds like the path that your good friend John McCain tried to carve as well.
It is a long path of 100 town hall meetings. He's coming up here this weekend. Yeah, I mean, you know, the New Hampshire experience is good for a candidate like me. I like talking about issues, and it's an antidote to big money. We're about to turn the whole Republican-Democratic process into advertising for soap, you know, where you get 30-second sound bites. And as long as you have the early primaries, that's an antidote to where we're taking this thing.
Well, and I did read recently that you have logged more campaign visits to New Hampshire than any other candidate at this point.
Well, that could be true. And, well, look at Donald Trump. I mean, how many town halls has he been where he took questions? I mean, I take every question under the sun. It makes me a better candidate. And quite frankly, very seldom do I come away from a town hall meeting not learning something.
Well, let's dive into some of the questions then. And I have a ton, Senator Graham, and our listeners I know will have a ton as well. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. I've got some Facebook comments for you already. You can find us on Facebook.
Sure.
Or Twitter. So, Senator Graham, I did want to start off with yet another mass shooting, this time in Oregon. Last time it was in your home state of South Carolina. What would a President Graham do to protect Americans from these attacks as they go about just the ordinary business of their lives? You know, my goodness, going to school, going to church, going to the movies. What would a President Graham do about this?
Well, I think there's some bipartisan opportunity here to deal with the mental health component of mass shootings. Not all, but most of them have something to do with an individual who's lost their way in life, like this young man out in Oregon had been discharged from the Army for trying to commit suicide. Senator Ayotte and myself have a bipartisan proposal that would allow states who've had adjudications regarding individuals in their state who are a danger to themselves and others to be enrolled in the federal background check system when you try to buy a gun. There's almost a million adjudications in this country that are not in the federal system. Let me give you an example. There was a lady from South Carolina who came back to the state after leaving the state who threatened to kill President Bush and his Secret Service agent. She was adjudicated a danger to herself and others, found not guilty by reason of insanity of trying to assassinate the president. She was confined to a mental health institution. She was released, went back to South Carolina, went to a gun store, bought a pistol, went to a private school in Charleston, went in the administrator's office and tried to shoot him and other people, and the gun jammed. Her whole adjudication wasn't in the system. So that would be a pretty darn good place to start, is to make sure we're capturing people who shouldn't buy guns because they're a danger to themselves and others. That's one small step in the right direction.
There's a bill in Congress that would make $400 million available to states to make sure people who are indeed, as you said, prohibited from buying a gun actually reported.
Yeah, I mean, they've already been adjudicated a danger to themselves. Like this young man, we need to look in the military. If you're discharged from the military because you tried to commit suicide, we need to somehow get that into the system. One, help the person. But also let folks know that, hey, this person's had an inclination to kill themselves.
Is that reporting to the federal background system by the states, is that mandatory?
It is in certain areas. But bottom line, this is one area where there's a hole in the system. You know, if you go buy a gun, you have a three-day period where they can run a criminal background check on you. 80,000 people have failed a background check over the last couple of years. 9,000 or 13,000, I can't remember, were felons on the run, and 50 people got prosecuted. One thing that President Graham would do is dedicate some resources at the Department of Justice to put people in jail who try to buy guns illegally.
Would you support Senator Graham making that information that you say is critical to stopping some of these terrible crimes mandatory? Because right now it's not 100% mandatory for states to hand in all those names.
Yeah, the grant program doesn't make it mandatory. It incentivizes them, and I think once you get some money on the table, they'll do it. But I'm willing to consider requiring enrollment of anybody that we think shouldn't buy a gun because they have mental health problems. I mean, that's a commonality in these shootings that we need to address somehow.
Well, and Republican candidates especially have focused more on this mental health issue, and some Democrats. But as you know, Senator Graham, so often these shooters show limited signs of trouble or no sign of trouble, and then they just snap. So how does an improved mental health system, better tracking, help with that?
Helps,
I mean, in some instances, it just seems all of a sudden they have an anger management
problem.
Unless
you just, you know, if you want to take everyone's gun in the country, and if you don't think you can do that, or you should do that, then you're just going to have to deal with the component parts of it. You know, keeping guns out of the hands of mentally unstable people, keeping guns out of hands of felons is a worthy goal for all of us to pursue. Then you got gun regulations. I own an AR-15. I'm going to go to a facility here in New Hampshire today that makes accessories for the AR-15. I've never heard anybody. We had an effort to ban assault rifles in Congress a year or two ago. 60 senators voted against banning the assault rifle as a particular weapon, limiting clips, the number of bullets in a clip. There was a story not long ago, maybe last year, where a felon got out of jail, served his time, broke into a lady's house. She had two twin daughters at home. They ran upstairs, got in the closet. He came up after them, opened the closet door, and she emptied a six-shot revolver and who is still able to crawl away. In that case, I wouldn't care if she'd had 100 bullets, but in the case of the felon himself, I wouldn't want him to have one. So everything's a balancing interest here against the Second Amendment.
Democrats are saying that there are weaknesses in the federal background check system. You mentioned this earlier. If a background check takes more than 3 days, then the would-be purchaser gets the firearm regardless.
Yeah,
is that a weakness or not?
It could be. Maybe that's too short a period of time. I'm certainly open-minded to extending the process if it's proven that the three-day period doesn't give people time enough to run the system. Like the guy, the roof guy, he was pending charges for drug possession in South Carolina. He should have been in the system.
This is the Dylan Roof.
Yeah, Dylan Roof. He was in two counties. He had got caught in one county and lived in another, and it just never got in the system. I tell you what President Graham would do. We would really look at the background system anew, upgrade the technology, spend a lot of money making sure that information is shared.
Would you extend that background check system to internet and gun shows? That's another point of contention.
Well, the gun show loophole, I haven't seen anything to make me suggest that you'd want to do that or that that's part of the problem. And here's a situation, you know, if a father gives a shotgun to their son for the 16th birthday, I don't see that being a need for a background check. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to look at the background check system, the waiting period, and see how much of this are we missing that we can capture. And here's the problem. Almost none of these cases involved somebody that was not mentally ill and that the information about them was not in the system when it should have been.
If the background check system is so important, as you seem to be saying it is, Senator Graham, why not extend it to internet sales and gun shows?
Well, because I don't know where that helps, quite frankly. Why would you extend a system that's broken? 80,000 people failed the current system we have. They were rejected by the system and 44 got prosecuted.
One more question about the mental health angle of this. We've talked about this a lot on this program, The Exchange. How do you talk about that mental health angle without targeting, tarnishing a large group of people who are suffering from mental illness and wouldn't hurt a soul? The people that we talked to in the mental health field are very upset about this.
And they should be. Here's the problem. You got competing interests here. You're trying to make society safer. You're trying to rightly control who gets a gun. And at the same time, you don't want to take rights away from somebody because they've had mental health issues. Almost every family is affected by some form of mental health, acute or chronic. And you have to have an adjudication process to take a constitutional right away from somebody. You know, having a bad day, does that mean you can't do this or you can't do that? In a free and open society, I don't know how you come to 100% solving this problem, because on the mental health side, what about somebody who's had PTSD in Iraq or Afghanistan where they have problems but they're not a danger to themselves or others? At what point do you trigger taking a constitutional right away or imposing treatment? Here's where we should all be able to agree. If a court of competent jurisdiction has made a determination you're a danger to yourself or others, then that should go into the system. If you're discharged from the Army because you tried to commit suicide, to me that's something that should go in the system.
What do you make, Senator Graham, of the comparisons that President Obama often brings up, that this doesn't happen in other countries? And his conclusion is, because we have too many guns, that you've got people with, you know, mental health problems in other places like Japan or France or wherever, but you don't see these mass shootings.
Well, you do have mass shootings in other places, but not to the frequency we have here. We do have a Second Amendment. So what does he suggest?
I just wonder what you think of the comparison. Are they doing something right that we're not doing?
I think we do some things right they don't do. We do have a Second Amendment. New Hampshire's a very gun ownership state, a lot of hunters up here. A lot of cultures, restrict firearms. I mean, most European nations, it's almost impossible to own a gun. That's not a road we're going to go down as a people. There are plenty of Democrats who would object to Europeanizing America. I mean, New Hampshire is live free or die, and part of that living free is to be able to be a responsible gun owner. And at the end of the day, you'd have to change the Second Amendment to really do anything substantial.
Our phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest this hour on The Exchange, South Carolina Senator and Republican presidential candidate Lindsey Graham. He's with us for the hour. We're getting his take on some of the top issues in this presidential race, and we'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, we've been talking about mental health and the role that it may play in some of these incidents. What specific steps would you take, Senator Graham, to improve the mental health system as a way to get at this problem?
Well, number one, it's covered now by private insurance. Senator DiMenci from New Mexico years ago was pushing me and others to join on a bill that would make sure that mental health was treated as if it were cancer or a broken leg.
Parity.
And, you know,
for those who have private
insurance. Yeah, I didn't know about that, but he had problems in his family. And I've got problems in my family, too. That finally became law. The more America can accept this, Patrick Kennedy, and I know Patrick very well. I really enjoyed, we didn't agree on a whole lot, but Ted Kennedy was a guy you could do business with. I think he's got a new book out, and I've talked to Patrick a bunch of times about this. Community health centers are out there all over the country. If I were president, I'd try to beef up the mental health component to that. Look here in New Hampshire. Look at the overdoses of heroin. It is just swamping your state. People start with prescription drug abuse, then they buy heroin because it's cheaper once they get hooked. So Senator Ayotte's got a bill that would help states like New Hampshire. But the way I would look at mental health is like early diagnosis, well, not so much early diagnosing, but how can you get delivery closer to the patient? Preventive medicine is something we should all be more focused on to keep people healthier longer. And a community health center provides access to middle-income and low-income Americans so they don't have to go to the emergency room. They'd actually have a medical home.
And there's a strong system of community mental health centers.
It's huge.
Here in New Hampshire. Would you support greater federal aid to these community
health centers? It's not mental health centers, community health centers.
More broadly.
Yes. And what I would bet that if you looked at a community health center, and I'm, matter of fact, I'm going to go tour around and see if my hypothesis is true, that the mental health component is probably pretty small. In the military, we don't have enough professionals to deal with the effects of PTSD and you know, enhanced suicide rates. It's an area of medicine, quite frankly, that we're not focusing enough on in producing the numbers we need and deploying those numbers closer to the patient.
One more question for you, Senator Graham, on this mental health issue. 40,000 Granite Staters now get mental health and substance abuse coverage under expanded Medicaid, which, as you know, is part of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Some people call it Obamacare. So in light of concerns that you've expressed about mental health, how much is Obamacare part of the solution?
I think it's going to be the part of the problem in this sense, that the reimbursement rates under Obamacare are going to drive providers out of business. Look at the number of medical care facilities that take Obamacare patients in New Hampshire. Very few. Medicare, if you're 65 or older, it's harder to find a Medicare doctor today than any other time because the reimbursement rates are below cost. Why? Because the federal government's the biggest provider of health care and we're broke. Our biggest expense by 2040 is Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security plus interest on the debt. But Medicare and Medicaid in terms of federal government liability, in terms of cost to the federal government, by 2040 is going to consume the entire revenue stream. So rather than expanding Medicaid as it is today, I would do away with Medicaid and replace it with a new system where there's some bipartisan support. What I would do...
Do away with Medicaid. Wait a minute. Yeah. Make sure you got your right
sure.
there.
Yeah.
Because, again, 40,000 people in this state
yeah.
are now getting mental health, physical health, I substance abuse coverage that they didn't have before.
Now, I didn't say I wouldn't cover them. I said I'd do away with Medicaid as a fee-for-service medicine model. What I would do is I'd take everybody within reason. If you make $80,000, you wouldn't be eligible for Medicaid because the federal government is broke. the obligations the federal government has regarding Medicare and Medicaid plus interest on the debt are going to consume the entire revenue stream because 80 million baby boomers are going to go into retirement and want Medicare. Now, what would I do for Medicaid? I would pick an eligibility point, and I would say every person, every family entitled to Medicaid, rather than paying for doctor treatment, we would enroll you into a health care plan.
That's kind of what New Hampshire is doing.
Yeah, but it's
the managed federal Medicaid under private providers.
Yeah, but they're doing it incrementally and with a lot of limitations from Washington. Ron Wyden, Lindsey Graham, six Democrats and six Republicans came up with the Wyden-Bennett bill. It made a trade-off. Everybody would be covered, just like Obamacare. And if you're not covered, you'd pay a fine if you could afford to pay one.
Okay, so far sounds like Obamacare.
Yeah, it covers everybody. But the trade-off is that everybody wouldn't be covered by the federal government, that we eliminated employer deductions. That created hundreds of billions of dollars that came back into the system to give individuals subsidies to buy private policies. We turned Medicaid away from fee-for-service, gave everybody choice in terms of enrolling in private health care plans so we could increase quality and lower cost. So the liberals had to give up on the idea that the government would control health care delivery. Republicans had to embrace the idea that everybody would be covered. And I think that's a model that makes a lot of sense.
You know, we talked earlier about your inside Washington experience, how that goes over with Republican voters. What about this reputation that you have, Senator Graham, as someone who works with Democrats? In some circles, that's not seen as a plus.
Yeah, it's probably not seen as a plus on the Democrats. I mean, you just convince me, and I'm open-minded here, this is your chance. Tell me how we get out of debt as a nation without Democrats and Republicans reforming entitlements that drive the debt. 80 million baby boomers are going to retire in the next 25 years. We're $70 trillion short of paying the Medicare and Social Security obligations promised to the baby boomers. We're down to two workers for every retiree in the next 20 years. Tell me how you save America from becoming Greece without fixing that. Tell me how you fix Medicare and Social Security without bipartisanship. Tell me how you fix immigration without both parties working together. Tell me how you do the big stuff from a party perspective. I'm dying to hear.
Well, speaking of the debt and your concerns around it, the CBO did report just yesterday that the budget deficit has dropped to $435 billion, the smallest deficit since 2007, the sixth consecutive drop in a row for the deficit. So how are you feeling better about that?
Not
is that progress?
No, we're spending at 2008 levels for the discretionary budget. 30% of federal spending is on the discretionary side, the Department of Education, the Department of Defense, the VA, housing and urban development. All these programs that deliver services get reauthorized every year. Two-thirds of the budget, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and interest on the debt are automatic expenditures.
You have to You have to pay for those.
We
you
have
no
lowered
choice
the deficit.
Lower
right. We have ratcheted down discretionary spending too far, I think. The military is on track to be the smallest army since 1940, the smallest navy since 1915. Number one, we need to replace these defense cuts and deal with our long-term unfunded liabilities.
Well, we'll talk about defense cuts, foreign policy. I know that's a strong point for you, Senator Graham. And we'll take more of your questions and comments. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're sitting down with Republican U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Lindsey Graham today on The Exchange, a longtime senator and House member from South Carolina. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments for Senator Graham are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Senator Graham, since I mentioned your home state, we've all seen the pictures of the terrible floods in South Carolina. I think at least 9 people have died. I know you were just there yesterday.
Right.
What's going on there now? What's the situation?
There are several dams that we worry about breaking. the water levels will probably crest from the upstate drain off to the coast this weekend. It's, I think, 15 or 16 deaths now. I've never seen so much rain in my life. I was in Charleston, Kiowa Island, Saturday, where it rained like 18 inches in 18 hours.
Wow.
It was a freak of all freaks, where you had a high and low part around South Carolina. As the hurricane passed, which was well offshore, it created a river of rain. It was drawing water from the hurricane, and it created a funnel right over South Carolina. And for about 36 hours, we got on average 18 inches, 2 feet of rain all over the state.
Well, environmentalists have long predicted powerful, unprecedented storms as a result of climate change. Are you making that connection with this storm, Senator Graham?
No, but I do believe climate change is real. I think CO2 emissions created by man are contributing to greenhouse gas effect, which in the result is that you have a planet that's heating up, that you, the CO2 emissions, the greenhouse gas effect is pretty simple. It traps heat. You know, I believe there was a hole in the ozone. You know, Ronald Reagan, President Bush, 41, dealt with it. I think most of the stuff we send up in the air has some effect. Acid rain was real. We're trying to turn the corner on that. So it's not much of a stretch to me to believe that CO2 emissions, you know, when you burn gas and oil and coal, that the CO2 created and, you know, by burning is creating the greenhouse gas effect. How much man is contributing, how much in North America versus the planet as a whole, I don't know. But I would certainly entertain a lower carbon economy as long as it was business friendly.
How do you account for the skepticism in your party, Senator Graham, over climate change?
Oh, I just think Al Gore oversold it. You know, Al Gore turned this thing into a religion. To me, it's a problem we're solving. And there is a some debate in the scientific community, but the typical Republican answer is, I'm not a scientist. Well, I'm not either. I didn't prove it. I made a D in science. The only reason I made a D is the teacher never gave anybody an F. So the bottom line is I've been to the Antarctic. I've been to Alaska. I've been to Greenland. I've traveled all over the world looking at this problem with some of the most prominent climatologists.
So you believe them?
Well, I've been on the ground. I've talked to the native people in, the Arctic and Alaska. Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious to me that the CO2 greenhouse gas effect is real. If I'm not a scientist, why not disbelieve 90% of those who are? It just never made a whole lot of sense to me.
In 2010, Senator Graham, you worked with then-Senator John Kerry to craft a system that caps carbon
Lieberman.
Emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what happened to that effort?
Well, it was a kind of a balanced approach. It expanded offshore drilling. We have oil and gas that we own in abundance, and we should go find it in an environmentally sound way. We're stuck with fossil fuels for a long time to come. Part of the bill had offshore drilling.
Was that the problem?
Well, the problem was it had the Gulf oil spill literally the day before the day before we announced the bill, and it was pretty impossible then to get a comprehensive approach because the Gulf was full of oil. And at the end of the day, it had a nuclear power component, which is a low-emitting form of energy. It had offshore drilling and allowed for fracking, and it set CO2 targets for industry and oil companies that they felt they could comply with. We'll take another shot at this. The EPA regulation on carbon being proposed by the administration, I think, goes too far, particularly for the Southeast. But having said that, if I were president, I would get the environmental community, energy producers in a room and see if we could come up over a 50-year period a lower carbon economy, hitting our carbon targets in the out years, rewarding, incentivizing alternative energy, wind, solar, but also nuclear power, find more oil and gas that we own, export some of it to make the world a safer place, undercut Putin's monopoly when it comes to natural gas, is a comprehensive approach to energy and the environment. And I'll just end with this. There'll never be an energy independence bill like I want without an environmental buy-in. To my environmental friends, you're never going to get the lower carbon economy you want unless you deal with a guy like me. And that's the great trade-off.
Regarding South Carolina and the storms there, I got a couple of Facebook comments about the disaster relief, and certainly it's going to be a big effort. I think either you or Governor Haley said a billion $1,000. But a couple folks on Facebook are asking why you opposed relief funds. This is from Brian on Facebook for the victims of Hurricane Sandy. Liz, why does he think only residents of his state deserve disaster relief? And on that same theme, Larian says, why is federal disaster for New Jersey a bad thing, but aid for South Carolina is okay? So a couple folks feeling like you're not really being fair there, Senator Graham.
Well, what they need to do is check out what we actually did. I'm a pretty fair guy. When it came to Sandy, devastating, got it. $60 billion was put together by the Democratic-controlled Senate. 47 states received community development block grant funding because of Sandy.
47 states.
47. They built a Amtrak line hundreds of miles away from Sandy. It was a pork fest. It wasn't even, nobody looked at this bill from helping Sandy victims. It became a pork-laden, pile on everything you can think of, get it while the getting is good bill. I voted for a $24 billion bill that would have put money into the system to help Hurricane Sandy until the next appropriation cycle. The Citizens Against Government Waste have looked at the $60 billion monstrosity and labeled it one of the biggest mistakes in Congress. 11% of the $60 billion was spent in the first year. Only 25% of the $60 billion has been obligated. So this was a pork fest. And what I will do is make a request, if one is appropriate, to the Congress for assistance for people of South Carolina based on the flooding and not one penny more. There are 46 counties, and I told every member of the County Administrators Association, if I find one penny in this bill unrelated to the flooding, you'll pay a price.
Thanks for those Facebook comments, Brian, Liz, and Larry. And again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Well, since you mentioned Senator Graham, Vladimir Putin, and especially what he's doing now on the world stage, here's an email from, Lori. Lori says, can you explain what is going on in Syria with Assad and Putin? And she asks, what needs to be done that our current president is not doing? Lori, thank you very much for the email. Go ahead, Senator Graham.
Thank you. Okay, so if you're at home, you're listening, you might want to get a flow chart.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Okay, number one, does it matter to us? Does it really matter to us who runs Syria? That's the first question. And I would say yes. I think these refugees flowing by the millions matter to us. We're a good people. Women are being brutalized, sold into slavery. 250,000 people have been killed. But I don't look at Syria as a humanitarian problem. I look at it as a national security opportunity and crisis. There's a war going on in the Middle East. Radical Islam on the Sunni side is represented by ISIL, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda. These are Sunni extremists who are trying to remake the religion in their own image. These are the people that throw gay couples off the roofs, that sell women into slavery, all in the name of God, that would kill every Muslim in their wake that doesn't convert to their view of Islam, which is 11th century view. They feel compelled to destroy the Christian faith and destroy Israel and come after us. That is an outlier in the Sunni faith. Probably 80% of Muslims are Sunni. Within this population of 80%, there is an extreme form of the Sunni religion that's expressed by al-Qaeda, and even to the right of that is ISIL. On the other side, on the Shiite side, the 20%, Iran represents, I think, a very radical form of the Shia religion. The average Iranian doesn't buy into this, but it's a theocracy in Iran. So you have a convergence of two great antagonists. ISIL's, if they had three people to kill, a Iranian Shiite, a Christian, or an Israeli, they would kill the Iranian Shiite first.
Within their own religion.
Yes. A close second would be a Sunni from Egypt. Anybody
who doesn't see it their way.
They'd eventually get to us, but the Israeli would come before us.
So what does this have to do with the question from Lori? Syria, Assad,
trying
Putin.
To setting the stage.
Okay. I know it's complicated.
Okay, it is. Okay, so Everybody says we need to degrade and destroy ISIL. President Obama says that. Here's a question. Why? Why do we need to degrade and destroy ISIL? From an American point of view, why does that matter? What would your answer be?
We're concerned that they would not only kill people in countries that we care about, like Israel or France or Britain, but also that they might come over here.
Yes. One, they're going to kill everybody, every Christian in the Mideast, and they're going to kill every Muslim that doesn't agree with them. They're going to destroy Israel if they can, and they're going to attack us because they've promised to do so. So if you buy into the idea that we should care, then we should do something about it, because I think it's a direct threat to the homeland. Al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIL, said when he was handed over by a colonel, American colonel, to the Iraqis, I worked at Camp Buka where he was housed as a prisoner of war. He said, I'll see you in New York. So the air campaign.
That's creepy.
It is creepy. He's a creepy guy. The air campaign will never destroy ISIL. It will degrade them. They're expanding.
You mean the U.S. air campaign?
Yes, or anybody's air campaign.
Russia's air campaign?
Not even close. They're going to survive air assaults. They're dug in.
So what do we do?
Somebody has to go in on the ground to destroy them.
Are the American people ready for that? They're still reeling from Iraq and all the deaths and destruction there.
I think the American people are ready to keep the war over there so it doesn't come here. I think the American people are ready to end the slaughter and to deal with this barbaric religious form of Nazism, but you got to do it smart. So,
Senator Graham, I want to invite our listeners to join us because I think they've probably got some thoughts on this. Let's go to Hillary in Meredith. Hi, Hillary. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange with Senator Lindsey Graham.
Hi, Senator Graham. How are you today?
Good. I'm trying to fight this cold, but other than that, I'm doing good.
Oh, no. Well, I wanted to just give you a quick call. I'm an Air Force veteran.
Yay.
Yeah, I know, right? Yay.
Air power.
There we go. And I have a quick question for you. Regarding, of course, national security, what do you think is the most important foreign policy issue that's facing us and facing our service members, that, you know, like you and me and the people that have served?
Right. Okay. Hillary, thank you very much.
The deterioration of our capability to adequately equip, train, and deploy our forces is a national security crisis in the making.
You mean defense spending?
Yeah, budget cuts. By 2021, we will be spending 2.3% of GDP on defense. The historical average has been 5% since World War II, literally in half. We're going to ground about 50% of the fighter squadrons that are combat ready today because we won't have enough money to keep them up in the air. We're going to go to a 420,000-person army from about 510,000, have 275 ships, have the smallest Navy since 1915. The ability to project force and to defend the nation is being compromised. The ability to keep people trained and safe, to have deployment schedules that don't break the backs of families, is very much being lost. So to this young lady, rebuilding military defense capability, number one priority to help families in terms of rotation schedules. I'm not looking for a fair fight. I want to modernize our force. The biggest threat of all is Iran with a nuclear weapon.
I'll ask you about that in just a moment.
I'll get back to Syria eventually.
So go ahead. Iran, you mentioned it. So okay, while let, you let's, did, let's, yeah, let's, go ahead, and then I've got an email
out,
on that for
let's
you.
Let's flush out Syria. So the president's right to want to degrade and destroy ISIL. You can't do it without Syria. We have 3,500 soldiers in Iraq. We need about 10,000 to change the tide of battle inside of Iraq. That would give us aviation battalions we don't have, more special forces, forward air controllers, more trainers and advisors to help the Iraqi army. The bulk of the ISIL forces are in Syria. That's where the headquarters are. Here's what I would do. I would get a regional army up, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey.
So not just a U.S. effort.
Oh, God, no. We would be 10% of this. What does Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Egypt have in common? They have large armies, and they hate the same two things we hate, ISIL, because ISIL would destroy these countries very quickly. The King of Jordan, I fear for very much so. They hate Assad because he's a puppet of Iran. So Russia has aligned themselves with Assad, who is a puppet of Iran. The region will never heal itself as long as Assad's in power, because the 250,000 people that have been slaughtered by Assad's forces all have family members. The Syrian people will never accept Assad as their leader. ISIL will be able to recruit unlike any time in their history because Iran is now in league with Assad. And from an ISIL point of view, this is the greatest fight you could join, a chance to kill Iranians supporting the Alawite Assad to clear the caliphate of these infidel Muslims. So this effort by Russia to prop Assad up means that the war never ends. People in Syria are going to keep fighting. The refugees are going to keep flowing. And ISIL is going to get stronger.
Let's take another call. Thank you, Hillary, for that one. Drew is in Portsmouth. Hi, Drew. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange with Senator Lindsey Graham.
Hi, Senator Graham.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good.
You just briefly spoke about this, but just wondering what your high-level strategy would be for the Middle East, specifically the Syrian refugees.
Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about the refugee end of it. We haven't discussed that yet.
The King of Jordan's under siege. 20% increase in population in Jordan.
Wow. It's a lot.
There's 600-something thousand that we know of, probably underreported. 11.4 million people have been displaced inside of Syria. Over 3-4 million have left the country. There are more Syrian children in primary schools in Lebanon than Lebanese children. Now, these two countries are going to fall if this war continues.
So should we bring in more refugees?
We should take some.
How many?
Well vetted. I'll leave that up to the experts. But what I'm trying to do is not turn my back on the refugees, because most of these people are fleeing because they have to. There could be ISIL fighters intermingled, but you can't use that as a reason to say no to everybody. So let's vet, take some, try to help people in the region. Hillary Clinton's come out for a no-fly zone inside of Syria, which would mean you wouldn't have to leave the country. But if you want to destroy the problem, the cancer itself, you've got to come up with a strategy that accomplishes two things, that pulls the caliphate of ISIL up by the roots, a regional army to go into Syria, 10% us, 90% them, literally destroy ISIL on the ground, and over time push Assad out.
How willing do you think those other countries, you mentioned Turkey and Saudi Arabia, how willing do you think they would be to join the U.S. in such an effort?
They're not willing to join Obama because he won't put Assad on the table. These 54 Free Syrian Army people we train, about 9 million apiece, they had to sign a contract that they would fight ISIL only. Nobody in Syria is going to take up arms just against ISIL. Even though they want to get rid of ISIL, they also want to get rid of Assad. He's the butcher who's, you know, mauled their families. So President Obama's unwillingness to take Assad on goes back to the Iran deal.
All right.
He's afraid to offend the Iranians by going after Assad.
And boy, so much to talk about, Senator Graham. Let's talk about Iran after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. More in a moment. Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Republican U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is with us, and let's hear from you. We're covering some of the big issues in this presidential primary, including national security, gun violence. A little bit later, we'll look at immigration. We've talked about climate change. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, if you'd like. And Senator Graham, here's an email that came in on Iran, which we should talk about. This person didn't give a name. He or she says the United States was unable to stop North Korea from developing nuclear weapons, and they are bankrupt and starving. Since the Republicans object to the nuclear deal with Iran because it doesn't prevent them forever obtaining a nuclear weapon, how would the senator specifically stop Iran from ever developing a weapon if they wanted to? Thanks to this person, Iran, it's a big deal, and I know you have a lot to say about it, Senator Graham.
Yeah, unlike North Korea, the Japanese and the South Koreans did not develop a nuclear capability of their own to counter North Korea. North Korea with nuclear weapons is a bad deal for the world because the guy in charge of North Korea is crazy. Now, the Ayatollah is a religious fanatic. Listen to what he says, what he wants to accomplish. The biggest mistake in Iran was separating their behavior on the ground, their support from terrorism and their nuclear program. Because what we've accomplished here is to relieve sanctions, infuse the regime with $100 billion of new money, purchase more weapons in 5 years, and build an ICBM in 8 years without requiring them to change their behavior. During the negotiations, and North Korea hasn't done this in the region, they've toppled four Arab capitals. The Houthis in Yemen, backed by the Iranians, drove out a pro-American government. We've lost the eyes and ears we once had on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a Sunni extremist group on par with al-Qaeda in Yemen. That's where they operate from. They launched the Paris attacks from Yemen. Because of Iran's meddling in the Mideast, destabilizing the region, our U.S. interests have been affected and that of our allies have been affected. They have substantial influence. Assad's a puppet. Hezbollah has a dominant say now in Lebanon, Yemen, and now Iraq. So I think it was a mistake for the ages to give them any sanctions relief until they change their behavior. As to the nuclear program, what have we accomplished? At the end of 15 years, there are absolutely no restrictions on their ability to take their enrichment program and reprocess uranium to weapons-grade level. So you've just put off, you haven't stopped, the development of a bomb. The most likely response by the Arabs is to one day go down the same nuclear path.
Because
by
other Arab nations.
Yes, the Sunni Arabs are not going to allow their chief antagonist on the planet, the theocracy in Iran, Shia Persians, to have a nuclear capability to hang over their head. Israel's widely known to have a large nuclear arsenal, maybe up to 100, who knows, nuclear weapons. Not one Arab nation felt a need to get a nuclear weapon in response to Israel. I just got back from the Mideast about 4 or 5 months ago, and every Sunni Arab leader I met with said that whatever you give the Persians, whatever you give the Shiites in Iran, we're going to want the same. So what would Lindsey Graham do as president? I would set this deal aside. I would ask the Congress to work with me, not against me. I would create a dilemma for the international community. If you did business in Iran, you could not use American banks. You'd have to pick between a $450 billion Iranian economy and American banking system.
Would be a pretty obvious choice, wouldn't
you? Yeah,
I think
so.
United States.
Yeah, I'd wait for the phone to ring and I'd say, listen, if the Iranians want a nuclear program for peaceful purposes, they can have it. Canada and Mexico have nuclear power plants. They just don't enrich uranium. I don't mind Iran having nuclear power. I mind them having the capability to build a bomb.
Well, and Senator Graham, this is a huge, huge issue. And I think we're going to have to tackle it another time because I want to go back to our listeners.
Sure.
White House definitely has a different interpretation of what this deal allows. So let's go back to our listeners who want to talk to you. And this is Eric in Portsmouth. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Senator. I'd like to say by thanking you for your military service.
Oh, thank you.
Also, sir, I was wondering if you would just give a real brief summary of your tax reform plan. I'm just starting to make a pretty good living these days, and I'm just scared to death that the taxes I'm going to pay are going to outweigh the bonus money and the raise I just received.
Well, congratulations, Eric, on the bonus anyway. Okay, and the salary. Go ahead, Senator Graham. Tax reform, yeah, another huge topic.
Tax reform has to be looked at in terms of what can you accomplish. Now, in a perfect world where I was king, I'd be a benevolent king, but I don't think I'm going to get to be a king. Eric, is that the
– Yes. Okay,
Eric, I'd have a flat tax. I'd have the top rate of 18% to 20%. I'd eliminate almost all deductions, maybe one or two, like charitable giving and deductions for your home interest. And I'd take that $1 trillion back that we give out in deductions, and I'd lower down rates so that we'd have maybe a 2 or 3 rate system, top rate 20%. I'd eliminate capital gains taxes. I'd eliminate the tax death tax to really – allow people to have more money in their pocket to create jobs. But I'm not going to get that perfect world because Democrats do exist, and they're not going to vote for that.
So a flat tax.
Yes. I tell you what I'd like, then I'll tell you what I think we can do. What you should worry more about than anything else, Eric, is that people in my business leave the long-term debt unaddressed. I don't know if you have children, but in the next 25 years, a tsunami of baby boomers are going to retire en masse. We're going to want our Social Security checks paid and our Medicare bills honored. by 2040, all the money you send to Washington and Texas, whether it's at 39 or 35 or 25, whatever rates, is going to go to pay the obligations of these programs plus interest on the debt. In 1983, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill together adjusted the age of retirement from 65 to 67. Because we live so much longer, it's time to do that again. Eric, people in my income level, I make $175,000 a year. I would have to pay more into Medicare because the average person takes out three times what they put in. I'd means test Medicare benefits.
Okay, let me just jump in there real quick. Some people say that's not a good idea because then you don't have buy-in from the American public. And in general, this program has bipartisan
support.
No,
I'm not
saying
I would eliminate Medicare. I'm saying I'd make it sustainable.
No, what I'm saying is if you start to means test it, then it becomes more like quote-unquote welfare.
Well, that's the argument people make for Social Security, and I agree with that. But let's talk about Medicare. The unfunded liability of Medicare swamps that of Social Security. Medical inflation is driving the debt and is driving cost increases in the private sector. If you don't fix Medicare, then the whole country fails. So what would I do with Medicare? Medicare Part D. The most you have to pay in prescription drug premiums is like $108 a month. If I were president, I would ask people at my income level to pay more than $108 a month for their prescription drugs. That would put new money into the system. I would expand Medicare Advantage so that seniors could buy products not covered by traditional Medicare. That new money helps doctors and hospitals. When it comes to subsidies for premiums, the average premium is about $550. There are Bill Gates and Lindsey Graham get subsidies from Medicare to pay our premium when we get to be 65. I would eliminate subsidies for people who make over $150,000 in retirement. I would do things to improve delivery of Medicare. I would increase the cost share by patients when it comes to Medicare Part D.
So to answer Eric's question about taxes, you would say one of the things you would do is tackle debt-related issues like Medicare and so forth.
Okay. I'm trying to solve the biggest problem first. So here's where taxes come in. I would adjust the age of retirement for Social Security based on reality. I would adjust the age of retirement for Medicare based on reality. I would means test both programs. I would get a smaller COLA because I make $175,000 a year from Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I would shave some basic benefits off my package to save the money for people who needed more when it came to Social Security. When I was 22, my parents died within 15 months. If it weren't for Social Security survivor benefits coming to my 13-year-old sister, we wouldn't have made it. We moved in with an aunt and uncle who never made over $25,000 in their life.
So you needed that
every
money.
Penny. I'm 60. I'm not married. I'll have a military retirement, a congressional retirement, a 401k plan. I could afford to give up some COLA and some basic benefits to save a system worth saving as to the tax side. Okay, so Eric, here's what I would do because I think it has to be part of a bigger deal. I think I could convince Democrats to lower the top rate for corporations to 28. I think I could lower the individual rate below 30. It's 39.5. And the way I would do that is that I would eliminate most deductions that we all enjoy or cap them. I'd either put a cap on deductions. You could only deduct up to X amount. You pick and choose. Or eliminate deductions except for charitable giving with a cap and mortgage interest with a cap and recapture most of that money we give out in the form of deductions and credits to pay down debt. And that would entice Democrats to means test and age adjust. It's called Simpson-Bowles. So the rates under Simpson-Bowles would be lower than they are today. They would be higher than I like. It would give you some tax relief. But the money that we recapture in terms of deductions and credits that are eliminated would go down to paying down, would go to debt retirement.
And then you could reduce taxes.
Yeah, and lower rates.
Let me ask you about
and anything else, Eric, is just talk because you're not going to get the tax reform I want or you want without dealing with Democrats, and you got to deal with the debt.
I want to ask you about another pocketbook issue, Senator Graham, that has been talked about a lot in various states and even cities. Some cities even have raised their minimum wage. People see that in those cities as a way to boost the overall local economy,
right,
because those low-wage workers will have more money to spend, help close the income gap and so forth. What do you think about the current federal minimum wage at $7.25 an hour? Is that adequate?
I think, well, it's not adequate to raise a family of four, and it's not meant to. It's adequate for a very weak economy. The middle class are people who are one broken-down car away from not going on vacation, one sick child away from having to rearrange the entire budget. You make too much to get government assistance, and you still live paycheck to paycheck. When Boeing came to Charleston, South Carolina, to open up the 787 plant,
when it famously left Washington,
to come to South Carolina, the bottom line is that every manufacturer in the Charleston area increased their wage rates or they would have lost all their employees to Boeing. If you're a waitress listening to this program, the best thing I can do as your president is to create an environment where you or someone else can open up a new restaurant. Demand for services is the only way the middle class will ever grow their wages.
So should we increase the minimum wage, Senator Graham?
No, because you'll knock people out of the workforce. You're not going to increase demand for services.
If people had more money, would they have more money to spend on
haircuts
and other
services? That's all in inflation.
Other services?
Haircuts go up. You want to help the middle class? Have companies move to New Hampshire that are hiring.
Senator Graham, you're going to have to come back because
there's
so much that we did not cover this hour.
You cut taxes in New Hampshire. That's a step in the right direction.
There's a lot we didn't talk about, but I really want to thank you so much. All right. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's Lindsey Graham, U.S. Senator from South Carolina and a Republican presidential candidate. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.